With me again to Exodus chapter 33, verse 1, and our passage continues to chapter 34, verse 9. And we're going to consider then this passage in our ongoing series on Exodus. We're going to consider this passage this morning under two headings. And notice with me, first of all, then, strangely unsatisfactory promises. That's our first heading, strangely unsatisfactory promises. And I'm referring in that heading to two promises in particular, which God makes to Moses in the latter part of chapter 33. The promises themselves, treated in isolation from the rest of the passage, seem hunky-dory. In both cases, it's other surrounding stuff that makes them unsatisfactory. Let me introduce you then to the two promises that I have in mind. And the first is in chapter 33, verse 14, where God says to Moses, "My presence will go with you." That's the promise. My presence will go with you. Now, in analyzing that, let's go back to the beginning of the passage and see how we get to verse 14. And the passage seems to begin very encouragingly in verses 1 and 2. There we read, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought up out of the land of Egypt, to the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your offspring I will give it. I will send an angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites.'" So after this long stay at Sinai, it's finally time for things to move on. The Israelites are going to proceed to the promised land, and they're going to possess the promised land, and that venture is going to be supernaturally assisted. God's angel, it says, is going to expel for the Israelites the land's present occupants. As I say, it all sounds then really rather heartening. But then comes verse 3. And to say that verse 3 drops a bombshell is something of an understatement. "Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey." Well, that continues the encouraging tone. It's the next bit that then shatters it. "But I will not go up among you." There's the bombshell. "I will not go up among you." The last part of verse 3 offers an explanation for this withholding of the divine presence. "Lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people." The explanation is then repeated in verse 5 with an added rhetorical flourish to intensify it. "If for a single moment I should go up among you, I would consume you," it says there. So exactly what does God mean? Is he saying that their tendency to be stiff-necked will inevitably keep resurfacing so that they'll be continually provoking him with fresh rebellions if he goes with them? Is that what he's saying? Well, I don't think he is saying that, because in that case, the phrase, "if for a single moment I should go up with you, I would consume you," is a bit over the top, isn't it? Even the Israelites were hardly going to be engaging in fresh rebellions against God every single moment. They were bound to have some good days, at least. There would surely be moments when they were behaving okay and God wouldn't be provoked to consume them. I think the point is the lingering stench of their vile sin with the golden calf is what would provoke God if he went with them. And that would be there every single moment. Being close to them on their journey, God would be unceasingly reminded of what they did that day at the foot of Mount Sinai. That's the reason for him distancing himself from them here. But notice that uncompromising declaration, "I can't be among you because I would consume you." Notice it's not the only note that struck in these verses. Some of the most breathtaking passages in the Old Testament are those in which God is torn, as it were. in which he announces some stern course of action in relation to his people, but then is suddenly overcome with reluctance. The book of Hosea is where you get that most conspicuously, but it's here too, as well as the note of uncompromising declaration. The note of reluctance is also clearly discernible in these verses. God doesn't really want to stay away from his people in the way that he's saying there in verses 3 and 5, I'm going to have to stay away from my people. Look at the last sentence of verse 5, where the austere definiteness of if for a single moment I should go up among you, I would consume you, suddenly collapses into an almost embarrassing hesitancy. So now take off your ornaments that I may know what to do with you. The significance of the ornaments, of course, is that they had a particular connection to the golden calf, and so will be a particular reminder to God of the golden calf. But the sentence just has the feel of a kind of desperate last resort on God's part. Such is his reluctance to withhold and withdraw his presence. Perhaps if you ditch your ornaments, then it might work for me to stay among you, dwelling in your midst. Give it a go anyway, he seems to be saying, and then I'll know what to do with you, he says. In other words, whether I really do have to withdraw my presence or whether I can, in fact, remain in your midst. Indeed, this reluctance is also writ large over verses 7 to 11. I take it that there's a chronological gap between verses 1 to 6, God's announcement, I can't dwell among you, and then the conversation that Moses has with God from verse 12 onwards. And when verse 7 begins, now Moses used to, it means during that gap. In other words, in verses 7 to 11, God has already withdrawn his presence. And these verses are giving us a taste of what that looks like. And to be sure, there's something a bit sad and a bit pitiful about the whole scene there in verses 7 to 11. But at the same time, the withdrawal of God's presence there is nothing like as thoroughgoing as it might have been. God still has a tent. And okay, it might not be the elaborate tent right at the heart of the Israelite camp that he's described in such detail on the top of Sinai. It might be a much simpler affair outside the camp. But God still has a tent. He hasn't abandoned that notion altogether, and still indeed he could be met with by the Israelites at that tent. Verse 7, everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting. So there isn't now this glaring absence of God from the whole scene, which is what you might have expected, because again, there's this tornness in him, you see. There's this reluctance residing in his heart. And I think then that when in verse 12, Moses says, see, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. I think he's expressing genuine confusion there. He doesn't really know what's going on here. God is being so ambivalent. On the one hand, declaring uncompromisingly, I can't be among you. But then on the other hand, demonstrating such reluctance to withdraw his presence. Moses is saying there, so who exactly are you going to send with me, Yahweh? Your angel, as you've said back in verse 2, or yourself? He continues in verse 13, please show me now your ways that I may know. You can sense his bemusement, can't you? He can't work God out here. And then notice that at the end of verse 13, he makes one very simple argument why he thinks God himself should accompany them and not just an angel. And he says there, consider that this nation is your people. Now, there's nothing very profound about that, is there? He didn't have to ransack all his theological know-how to come up with that line. It's very basic stuff, and yet, bizarrely, it does the job. And immediately in verse 14, you have God making this U-turn and making this promise, my presence will go with you. And I'm saying then that that promise is unsatisfactory because it just doesn't seem to have any real basis. Nothing in the objective realm has changed since verse 3 when God was saying the opposite. I will not go up with you. This promise now isn't the result of some solid, game-changing development that has occurred since God uttered those ominous words in verse 3. It's simply the culmination of a process of internal vacillation on God's part. Indeed, you sense, don't you, that Moses is a bit dubious about this promise in verse 14, because in verses 15 and 16, he continues to argue why God should go with them as if nothing's happened, completely ignoring the fact God has just said that he will now go with them. Moses seems to find the promise unsatisfactory and inconclusive. He has to secure a reiteration of it in verse 17 before he appears to be remotely convinced by it. I mean, the only thing that does change between verse 3 and verse 14 is this business with the ornaments. We read in verse 6, "Therefore the people of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments from Mount Horeb onwards." So if you're looking for some basis on which, despite what he has said in verse 3, God can, after all, dwell among the Israelites, unreminded of and unprovoked by the golden calf atrocity, that's all you'll find. The removal of those ornaments. Talitha was recently on a Duke of Edinburgh expedition, and on the walk they came to a field which they had to walk through, and a field then which contained within it a bull. And so they phoned the teacher who was responsible for the expedition to ask her what they should do about this, and her response was that they should proceed through the field, but they should throw a cap onto the ground, as the cap then would distract the bull from being interested in them. Now, to be fair to the teacher, it worked, and Talitha is still here with us to tell the tale. But nonetheless, if you're a human being and there's a bull nearby, you really want to be able to stake your safety on more than just a cap, don't you? A fence, maybe. A gun, maybe. A powerful quad bike, maybe, that you could get onto and speed away from the thing on. Not just a cap. And if you're a recent golden calf worshipper, and there's a holy God nearby, you really want to be able to stake your safety on more than just some unworn jewellery. I'm saying the promise in verse 14, for all its intrinsic beauty, it seems to rest on a flimsy and fragile basis. That's why I'm saying it's unsatisfactory. Then the second promise to which I want to draw your attention is in chapter 33, verses 21 and 22, where God says to Moses, "You shall stand on the rock while my glory passes by." That's the second promise. You shall stand on the rock while my glory passes by. The background to this is Moses' request in verse 18, "Please show me your glory." We don't know exactly why he suddenly comes out with that. I suppose he had had a major experience of God prior to the first main stage of his leadership of Israel, leading them from Egypt to Sinai. Prior to that, he'd had a major experience of God at the burning bush. Now he's embarking on the second main stage of his leadership of Israel, leading them from Sinai to the Promised Land, and perhaps he feels therefore the need of another major experience of God. And the promise then, "You shall stand on the rock while my glory passes by itself it sounds as though God is straightforwardly complying with Moses' request. But then you look at the other accompanying details, and you realize that that isn't really the case at all. Because actually, it turns out Moses isn't going to be standing on the rock as God's glory passes by. He's going to be in a cleft of the rock, some kind of cave or something. All right, you say. So he'll only be able to see the glory for a brief second as it actually crosses the opening of the cave that he's in. Well, no, his view won't even be as good as that, because actually the opening to the cave is going to have a cover over it. "I will cover you with my hand," God says. Okay, you say. So presumably the idea is that Moses will just see in the cracks between God's fingers glimpses of the glory as it crosses the opening to his cave. Well, no. The idea actually is that as the glory crosses the opening to his cave, he won't see it at all. I will cover you, end of verse 22, with my hand, until I have passed by. Now, God does make a tiny concession there in verse 23. As the glory, having passed by, recedes into the distance, then the hand covering the cave will be removed so that whatever lingering afterglow he is able at that point to sense, he's able at that point to reach Moses, still buried within the bowels of all this rock. He will see that. What God refers to as his back there. But it is a tiny, tiny, tiny concession. Well, okay, you might say, perhaps in the event itself, when it occurs in chapter 34, perhaps when it actually happens, things will be better than seem to be being intimated here at the end of chapter 33. And perhaps the reality will, in fact, closely match the promise, you shall stand on the rock while my glory passes by. Well, no. If anything, the gulf between the promise and the reality becomes wider when the event actually occurs there in chapter 34. Imagine, for a moment, a trip to the National Gallery in London. And you're very excited about this trip that you're making there, and before you go, you research all the different works of art that you want to see as you tour that gallery. But then when you get there, there's been a security alert which has necessitated them taking down all the paintings. And that's obviously a bit of a blow, but so as not to disappoint the visitors to the gallery too much, they've replaced the works of art with transcripts. So you go over there, therefore, to a place where there should be a painting of, I don't know, a woman sitting on some grass beneath a tree with a lake in front of her. And there's still a frame, the right size, and it just kind of says along the bottom, grass. It says at the side, tree. And a bit further over there, it says lake. And it's all just bare words. And painting after painting is that throughout the whole gallery. I think you'd probably leave feeling that you hadn't really seen the paintings at all. And Moses' sight of God's glory ends up being just like that. It ends up being a transcript. Bare words. Verse 6 of chapter 34, the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, and so it goes on. Words. A verbal transcripts. Now, the reason then for all of this is given in chapter 33, verse 20. You cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live. And the validity of that reason God gives seems to be confirmed, doesn't it? When actually, even this very toned down experience that Moses has, ending up with just words rather than any sight at all, even that actually seems to have quite a profound effect on him. And in verse 8 of chapter 34, he bows his head towards the earth and worships. This is where the National Gallery analogy breaks down. You leave the National Gallery feeling shortchanged. Moses doesn't leave Mount Sinai here feeling shortchanged. He leaves feeling awed. So if there had been the actual sight of the glory which Moses had originally requested, then goodness knows what would have happened to Moses. Indeed, he could not have seen it and lived. But you still can't help feeling, can you, that given that Moses requests to see God's glory, and given then what the experience ends up actually being, the promise, you shall stand on the rock while my glory passes by, is unsatisfactory. And so that's the first thing then that we need to understand before we can understand what I'm going to say next. We need to understand that there are in this passage these two unsatisfactory promises. But let's move on then to our second heading, stunningly upgraded privileges. We've seen these strangely unsatisfactory promises. Let's notice now stunningly upgraded privileges. And the reason for that heading will become clear, hopefully, in a moment or two. And I want to continue then with this idea of Moses not really being able to see God's glory, and this idea of it not being safe for Moses to see God's glory. Why is that? I think we need to think quite carefully about this. And perhaps it might help to think of an analogy, and to think then for a moment about water. Think about water, and when is water dangerous? Well, we might instinctively think when it's deep. It's a case of more water, more danger. But actually, of course, it's often the case that deeper water is safer than shallow water. If you're boating, deeper water is safer than shallow water. If you're jumping in from a height, deeper water is safer than shallow water. It's a case of more water, less danger, because the greater the volume of water, it submerges and neutralizes the threat of the rocks in the water, which otherwise might imperil you as you are boating or as you are jumping in. Now, when is a display of God's glory dangerous? And instinctively then, we might think, well, when it's full on. It's a case of the more glory on display, the more the danger. But it doesn't work like that. Because what is the glory of God? Well, look at chapter 33, verses 18 and 19. And it's very interesting, isn't it? Moses says, please show me your glory. And God said, I will make all my glory pass before you. Ah, no, it doesn't say that, does it? I will make all my goodness pass before you. God substitutes the word goodness for the word glory, because presumably it means the same thing. God's glory is goodness. Well, then you look at that transcript, as I called it, all those words in chapter 34, verses 6 and 7. And what is it? It's a catalogue, isn't it, of warm, inviting attributes, merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. That, I think, and we'll see why I'm saying that in a moment, that, I think, is a kind of summary of the whole thing. If you want to boil it down to one phrase, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. That's the glory of God. That, in other words, is what makes him so unique and so incomparable. It's what we sang, isn't it, at the start of our service this morning, that extraordinary hymn by Samuel Davis, Great God of Wonders, all thy ways are matchless, godlike and divine, but the fair glories of thy grace, more godlike and unrivaled shine. Such dire offences to forgive, such guilty daring worms to spare, this is thy grand prerogative, and in the honour none shall share. Angels and men resign your claim. In other words, you think you're gracious. Forget it. Resign your claim to pity, mercy, love and grace. These glories crown Jehovah's name with an incomparable blaze. The heart of the glory of God is this grace, this goodness, this steadfast love and faithfulness that marks him out from all men, from all angels, from all pretend gods, from everything else, that makes him so utterly and uninventably unique. And that being so then, actually for us sinners, it's a case of the more glory on display, the less danger. You see, there's something within God's being that presents a grave threat to us. It's mentioned there in verse 7. Who will by no means clear the guilty? Who will by no means clear the guilty? And we, of course, as human beings, are all guilty. And when then the glory of God's grace and mercy and forgiveness is toned down, it's insufficient to neutralize that threat. That's Moses' problem here in our passage. This retributive aspect of God's being, it imperiled Moses as a sinful man, and the glory of God's grace and mercy and forgiveness is too meager here and too underwhelming to neutralize that and to counteract that. Which is why, at this point, we must turn to another passage. And that passage is very well known to you. It's John chapter 1. John chapter 1, verses 14 to 18, where, as you will all be aware, John exclaims, John 1, 14, we have seen his glory. You think, what, John? Did I hear you right? We have seen his glory. So John, what rock were you hiding in then? When did this happen, that you were put in a cleft of a rock and God's hand covered you so that you couldn't actually see the glory you're saying you see? No, John says, we have seen his glory. Full stop. End of. We have seen his glory. How's that possible then? How's that possible? Well, not because, John isn't saying it's possible because I and the other people I'm speaking for, we have been given a lesser display of glory than Moses was given. Rather, it's because we have been given a fuller display of glory than Moses was given. That's the exact language he uses, isn't it? Language of fullness, full of grace and truth. Almost certainly he has Exodus 34 in mind, and grace and truth are his equivalents for steadfast love and faithfulness there in Exodus 34. The glory of God's grace and truth, you see, displayed to Moses was relatively low level. The glory of God's grace and truth displayed to us, John is saying, is full. It's full. What's he talking about? What is this revelation? Well, it's Jesus, because he continues, doesn't he, in the verses that follow to speak of Jesus Christ. He says in verse 16, from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. Don Carson says that is best translated grace instead of grace. The point being then that there was grace in the glory which Moses encountered, but a greater grace in the glory that we have encountered in Jesus, which supplants and supersedes that earlier grace. And John concludes then in verse 18, no one has ever seen God. No one, including Moses. But now we have seen him. We have seen God in Jesus. And the glory of God's grace and truth then is so overwhelming in Jesus that it neutralizes the threat of that retributive aspect of God's being, the by no means clearing the guilty aspect. It swallows that up. John's gospel will go on to explain how it does. Through the cross, the grace and truth of the glory in Jesus is so deep and rich and vibrant, it will go to insane lengths to remove all threats to us. To us sinners that are inherent within God's being. The glory of God is full enough in Jesus, I'm saying, that we can safely view it. That's the point. The glory of God is full enough in Jesus that we can safely view it. And the we does include us. Don Carson again says, the we in verse 14 may have begun with John and the earliest eyewitnesses, but it now includes all who share the same faith. And that's why I'm referring then to stunningly upgraded privileges. You and I are in an immeasurably more privileged situation this morning than Moses. For Moses, it was dangerous to look at the glory of God because the glory of God's love and mercy and forgiveness was too meager and too dim. That's what made it dangerous. In Jesus, the glory of God's love and mercy and grace is full on. And it's safe for sinners to look at. Would we view his highest glory? Here it shines in Jesus' face. Think for a moment about a great animal at a zoo. Perhaps a polar bear. And I'm not here making any sort of political point about zoos, but there is something a little bit sort of pitiful, isn't there, about a polar bear at a zoo. And there's this creature that is naturally designed to feast its eyes upon great kind of glaciers of ice and great mountain ranges and all the beauties of that Arctic environment. And instead, it's in a little enclosure, and all it's looking at is tourists with their cameras flashing and buildings in the distance and all the rest of it. Well, you and I were made to gaze on the glory of God. We were made to gaze on the glory of God. And the pitiful and sad situation of millions of human lives is that the best they can find to feast their eyes upon is created stuff. Stuff that isn't the glory of God. And it might be beautiful stuff. It might be sunsets and mountain ranges. It might be polar bears, but we were designed to feast on the glory of God. And we'll never be satisfied in our souls when we're not doing that. And the invitation of the gospel is you can gaze on the glory of God. You can do that thing that you are wired up to do. You can come this morning to Jesus Christ, and you can start to fulfill for the first time the very purpose of your existence, because you can see in him the glory that you were designed to enjoy and to savor and to relish. Won't you do that? And just one more thing as we close. Remember the first unsatisfactory promise that we looked at this morning. That promise that my presence will go with you there in chapter 33, verse 14. And we said then, didn't we, that that promise is great in itself, but it has such a flimsy basis here, these unworn ornaments. Well, again then, if you're a Christian this morning, you have this stunningly upgraded privilege that God's presence is with you in your life. You can sing Psalm 139 that we sang this morning meaningfully. You can sing it with tomorrow morning in mind, wherever you're going to be tomorrow morning. Psalm 139 holds true, and there he will be with you, and there his right hand will hold you. And it's this profound reality for every single Christian. My presence will go with you into your office, into your school, into every situation where you are. But your privilege then as a Christian is that God is with you in your life tomorrow, not on the basis of your jewelry choices, but on a far, far firmer, more robust basis. That verb in chapter 33, verse 6, stripped, the people of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments, is a very strong verb in the Hebrew. In the Greek translation of Exodus 33, the verb isn't quite as strong, but it still refers to a reasonably forceful action. And interestingly, that same Greek verb that's used in the Greek version of Exodus 33, verse 6, it's used once in the New Testament in relation to sins. So here it's ornaments being taken away. Taken away is more the meaning of the Greek word. But in Hebrews 10, 11, it refers to sins being taken away, the exact same Greek words. And that then is how you and I can be assured that God will be safely present in our lives this week without us being consumed by that presence. Not that we've stripped off some item of our attire, but that Jesus, by his cross, has stripped off our sins. It's what we're going to be remembering in just a moment as we eat the bread, as we drink the wine. It's the body and blood of Jesus that strips away all our sins, and that means then that you and I can have God in our lives tomorrow. And that's not a terrifying thing. And that's not a dangerous thing. And it's not something that might mean by the end of the day we've been consumed because we've committed some sin. It's a safe thing because Jesus has taken away our sins. He's taken them away utterly. He's taken them away irretrievably. He's taken them away to a place where they are beyond recall. Those ornaments, what if one Israelite happened to forget this business and one day got out their earrings? And it provokes the anger of God. One sin can't pop up this week, next week, any week, to provoke God's anger against you, because Jesus has taken them away utterly, finally, terminally. What a thing it is, isn't it, to be a Christian? Amen.